This talk was given by Patrick Yunan Kelly at the Zen Center of New York City. Yunan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
So good morning. Is that working? My name's Yunan. I'm a senior lay student here in the order. And so this morning, what I wanted to talk about is being an ordinary human being. And in a sense, it's impossible to talk about that without ruining it, but because everyone is. But I'm going to talk about it anyway. And hopefully, you'll get something out of it. This is ordinary life in New York. So let me, I want to start with that. This is a poem by Walt Whitman. This is called Song of the Open Road. Afoot and light-hearted, I take to the open road. Healthy, free, the world before me. The long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. Henceforth I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Henceforth I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Done with indoor complaints, libraries, querulous criticisms. Strong and content, I travel the open road. The earth, that is sufficient. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know they are very well where they are. I know they suffice for those who belong to them. Still, here, I carry my old delicious burdens. I carry them, men and women, I carry them with me wherever I go. I swear it is impossible for me to get rid of them. I am filled with them, and I will fill them in return. So this has been kicking around with me. It decided to visit me a few weeks ago, and it's been staying, so I decided to talk about it. I was also thinking about Myotai Sensei, who is a big fan of Whitman, who's one of our non-Buddhist Brooklyn ancestors. And Myotai, if you haven't met her, she really got this place up and running. When we were, this center used to be in Manhattan in the 90s, and I think it was 2000 we moved here. And even if you haven't met her, if you practice here, you've met her. It's thanks to her that we have this place, really. And she also, she planted that big tree out front. So often, I think for many of us, for me certainly, when we start Zen practice, there's something we feel that's lacking about our ordinary life. Something's missing. And so we start looking. And maybe this resonates with us and we decide to give it a try. Start sitting zazen. And then, very gradually, maybe, something starts to shift. You may not even notice it, or you may notice it. I was, it's most noticeable after you do a long period of intensive sitting, say a Zazen Kai or a session. I remember actually noticing something like this when I was a kid, before I even started practicing. I went to a, midday matinee theater. You're in there in the dark watching the whatever drama it was, I can't remember. You go out the back door in the dark, and then you open the door into this brilliant hot summer day, just an ordinary afternoon. But it seems so much more vivid than whatever it was that was on the movie screen. And it takes a few minutes, your eyes get used to it, and then you forget about that. But So that's my experience of Zazen too, sometimes. And I was also, I remember, I don't know if any of you are familiar with a man named Isan Dorsey. He was a practitioner at the San Francisco Zen Center a while ago, a student of Suzuki Roshi. He died of HIV in, I think, 1990. But he was involved in setting up the Zen hospice there to take care of people who were dying. And some of Suzuki's senior students were sitting around at one point, you know, swapping stories about their favorite memory of their teacher. And his story was, yeah, once I remember I was at Tassajara and he walked past me holding a teacup. And everyone was like, yeah, and? He said, that's it. He just walked past me holding a teacup. There was something about how he held that teacup that really stuck with me. Henceforth, I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. It's a lovely way to put it. You know, after a while, after it starts to sink in, you realize that things happen to you. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. Some of them are a cause for joy and some are cause for grief. But your good fortune doesn't depend on that. You are good fortune. And not only that, everyone you encounter is good fortune. You know, it doesn't... So the people that you like are good fortune. The people that you don't like are good fortune. The people that like you are good fortune. The people that don't like you are good fortune. Even, being in a bad mood, having something, you know, disappointing or unpleasant happen is good fortune. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a chapter about Avalokitesvara. So Avalokitesvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion. Canon. We chanted this morning, Canon Bodhisattva perceives the cries of the world. Avalokitesvara means the one who perceives the cries of the world. There's a statue of her in the back there that Myotai had set up. Sometimes Avalokitesvara is a woman, sometimes a man, depending on it changed from one context to another. But this chapter of the Lotus Sutra, it's a real focus of a lot of devotional practice in Chinese Buddhism. People will take this chapter and chant it over and over and over. It's a practice. In this chapter, it says that Avalokitesvara hears the cries of those in need. And if a being needs a monk, a nun, a layman, or a laywoman, Avalokitesvara appears as a monk, a nun, a layman, or a laywoman. If someone needs a young boy or a young girl, Avalokitesvara appears as a young boy or a young girl. I find this a really interesting practice to work with just in daily life, you know, to think, to actually practice the people that I encounter. This is Avalokitesvara trying to wake me up. Or you could turn it around. You are Avalokitesvara trying to wake them up. And even, or perhaps especially, when someone pushes your buttons or there's some interaction that makes you uncomfortable or afraid or annoyed or agitated, where is Avalokitesvara there? It's worth asking. And so, that person that gets under your skin, is that an undercover bodhisattva? Are they just annoying? What about you? Are you an undercover bodhisattva? Are you just annoying? I mean, how would you know? I was a couple of years ago, I was at Seishin at the monastery, and I was going to, you know, I was really kind of annoyed at everyone and at the MRO and practice. And I was just generally cranky. And one day during the rest practice, I was sleeping up above the Zendo just on the floor in the hallway. There's not a lot of chance to sleep during session, so you take it where you can get it. And then it was pretty cold. It was in winter. And someone came while I was asleep and covered me with a blanket. And I don't know who it was. And, you know, I had been cranky the whole time. And now I realized I had to walk through, and everyone I encountered, it's like I would get annoyed at people, but then I would think, well, wait, maybe that was the person who put the blanket on. And I didn't know who it was, so I had to do that with everyone. Daito Roshi used to say, if you want to save all sentient beings, you have to be willing to be saved by all sentient beings. Who is the one who's saving? Who is the one that's saved? Who knows? The earth. That is sufficient. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know they are very well where they are. I know they suffice for those who belong to them. It can be hard to accept other people's humanity, and maybe harder to accept our own. You know, we want so badly to escape the ordinary human realm, maybe into paradise, and we demand to be admitted to paradise right now. But the problem is that we're convinced it's somewhere else. And once we start putting energy into that, you know, we miss it. I often, when I do beginning instruction, I often mention that the Buddha, when asked what he taught, he said, I teach suffering and the cessation of suffering. And then I sometimes say, he could have said, I teach liberation and the cause of liberation. But I think he said it better. I mean, we have to face what we don't want to face about ourselves and about other people too. You know, we've been we have this group here that we've had for a year or two. We call it the What Is Whiteness Anti-Oppression Group, and it's for people who identify as white to try and really look at and examine how we're affected and how we perpetuate the sort of history of brutality in this country. And it's not, the idea is not to dwell in it or to practice self-flagellation, but really to liberate all beings dealing with this particular time, place, position, degree, trying to see what we don't see. We've been studying a book by a woman named Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility. And she deals with maybe the difficulty that many, perhaps most white people have in dealing with uncomfortable feedback about race or difficult conversations around this topic. And she says, she speaks a lot about it, and then she says, I have two guidelines that I aspire to for myself. She says, one, how, where, and when I receive feedback is irrelevant. I will take it any way I can get it. And two, thank you. And she says, the above guidelines rest on the understanding that there is no face to save and the game is up. And she's talking about a particular situation, but this is, I mean, as I understand it, this is Zen practice too. All of that's an excellent description of Zen practice. And so we have a number of tricks, or maybe I'm speaking for myself, but I doubt I'm the only one, to avoid our being an ordinary human being. You know, we want to be something else, you know, to be enlightened, blazing with light. I mean, that's a good aspiration. So sometimes, you know, we'll find someone and put them up on a pedestal. I mean, so this is a universal human thing. You know, could be a historical figure, someone in some endeavor whose skill you admire, a celebrity, a Buddhist teacher, and putting someone up on this pedestal, it can be useful. You know, it can inspire us to really to reach outside of what we know. But if we attach to it, it can be not helpful to ourselves, because in some sense we're avoiding responsibility for doing our own work. We're trying to ride on someone else's coattails. And it's also, in some sense, dehumanizing to the person who you're putting on the pedestal, because it's, putting them in a kind of box. one of the grave precepts. So the Buddhist precepts are, they're sort of like ethical and moral. They're not really rules. They're sort of guidelines pointing at what it means to be an awakened person. And one of those, the seventh grave precept is, see the perfection. Do not elevate the self and blame others. And, you know, you could also turn this around. Do not elevate others and blame the self. And speaking then of, elevating the self and blaming others, there's of course, identifying someone who you really can't stand and fixating on them and blaming them. And everyone knows this, you know, there's someone at work, maybe it's someone in the Sangha, maybe a political figure. I mean, if you come around here long enough, someone will appear who just pushes all of your buttons and drives you bonkers. It's just the way it works. And, you know, your work is maybe to try and find a way in. It's a very powerful, that is a manifestation of Avalokitesvara. I mean, it's not, you know, we think of this stuff as sometimes being just sort of nice and sweet, but it can be pretty fierce sometimes. And it, you know, it's not to say that there aren't situations where maybe someone's in a position of power that something destructive is happening, and that needs to be addressed, needs to be rectified. So it's not about just being nice, you know. Sometimes it's fierce, as I said. Fundamentally, the whole point of this is the liberation of all beings in all conceivable realms of existence. You know, we have a lot of rules here, but really that's the only rule. But when you, sometimes it is necessary to take sides, but then, you know, the challenge is to do it without hatred, to take sides without taking sides. I was just thinking about an interview with the Dalai Lama that the Dalai Lama gave not too long after the Iraq War. And this interviewer was asking him about, you know, where are some of the people you admire? And he said, well, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, George Bush. The interviewer said, what? Wait. But this guy started a war. How can you? He said, oh, I love George Bush. As for some of his policies, I have maybe some reservations. And then later, perhaps as a outcome of that response, he was addressing, I don't know what it was, the American Conservative Union or some more conservative group. And they were asking him about his economic beliefs and stuff. And then at one point he says, well, you know, I'm Marxist. I said, what? But the Chinese Marxists invaded Tibet. They're not Marxists, they're capitalists. I remember at the monastery once, when Daito Roshi was still alive, people were talking about the Dalai Lama. And Daito was kind of there quietly listening. And then all of a sudden he goes, you know, the Dalai Lama kind of pisses me off. He dumps things down too much. And I didn't say anything. I wasn't going to walk into that. But later I remember he attended, there was a function at Gracie Mansion for the ecumenical clergy thing. And the Dalai Lama was there, and Daito was there too. And the Dalai Lama saw him, and he walks up to him, and he goes, oh, Zen Master, whack. And then he took his hand, and he held his hand for the rest of the conference. Very sweet. Still here, I carry my old delicious burdens. I carry them, men and women. I carry them with me wherever I go. I swear it is impossible for me to get rid of them. I am filled with them, and I will fill them in return. You know, there's a fantasy that with enough practice, at some point in the future, our problems will all go away. Our neuroses, our demons. Actually, I just thought of there's a story where Shariputra is one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha. He was practicing, and a demon decided to tempt him. So the demon came up to him and demanded that he cut off his right hand and give it to him. So Shariputra did this. He cuts off his right hand, and he hands it to the demon. And the demon got really upset and offended because, you know, he handed it to him with his left hand, which is an offensive gesture. And so Shariputra got upset and became an Hinayana practitioner. I guess maybe he changed his mind at some point. But as I was saying, I don't think there's any state in which there aren't any more problems. You know, we chant, delusions are inexhaustible. They really are. As long as there are beings, there are problems. You know, your life, the fact that you are, causes problems. The fact that I am causes problems. Your parents had to exert all sorts of effort, or whoever raised you. You know, I consume resources. I'm, to some degree, complicit in these sort of unjust social systems, even though I try to do better. Once at the Zen Center of Los Angeles, where Daido was studying with Maizumi Roshi, this is in the 70s, at some point everyone was reading, there's that book, you've maybe seen it, I'm Okay, You're Okay. And everyone there was reading this book, and Maizumi Roshi walks in and he sees it, he picks it up, he says, I'm okay, you're okay. Maybe I'm not okay, you're not okay, and that's okay. So, you know, other people will disappoint you. You'll disappoint yourself. It's inevitable. You'll come up against your own limits, shortcomings, faults. Ultimately, old age, sickness, and death. You know, if you're lucky to live long to get old age, there's no guarantee. You know, everything that that you care about is impermanent. You know, it's hard to bear. And along the way, you have your own faults to deal with. I mean, what a deal. But, you know, there is a way in here. And Whitman, he points it out very nicely. You know, my old delicious burdens. There's a way of taking them on, you know, joyfully. Daido used to always say about this temple, you know, the lotus and the fire. The fire is all of the delusion and samsara and disappointment. It's because the fire burns that the lotus can bloom, he would say. You know, you put it in a pot of distilled water and it'll be dead in a day. So there's all sorts of, in your ordinary human life, all sorts of disappointments and joys too. I don't want to make it grim or anything, but you know, there is pain in the world. But, you know, I found in my experience that the capacity to love this life, this ordinary life, there's really no limit. I mean, as to how far you can take it, it's bottomless. And I think that's our work. I want to close. This is a poem, and I was hesitant to read this because it's from Dongshan, and it's a rather advanced teaching which I don't claim to really understand, but I love the poem, so I want to read it anyway. He says, who dares to equal the one who falls into neither being nor non-being? Everyone wants to leave the current of ordinary life. This one, after all, comes back to sit among the coals and the ashes. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.